We're going to be in Hebrews chapter 10 today, so go ahead and turn in your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 10. We're going to be in verses 26 through 39. But before we get there, I do want to start off by talking about a story that Jesus tells in the Gospels. In Luke chapter 12, verses 35 through 46, Jesus tells a story about this guy who goes off to a wedding feast, and he leaves some servants in charge of his house. Now, the thing about an ancient wedding is you had no idea how long it was going to last. Like, it could last for a couple days. It could last for a couple weeks. I mean, it's basically they partied until they decided the party was over and they went home. And so the point of the story was that he went away for an indeterminate amount of time. So this guy, he goes off to this wedding feast, and he leaves his servants in charge of his house while he's gone. Now, imagine for just a moment that you're one of these servants. Your master's gone. You don't know how long he's going to be gone for. It could be a long time. What do you do? Some of you are thinking, party, right? Well, Jesus says, if you're wise, you're going to do the things that you're supposed to do. Now, the servants, they would have had this, they would have had a task list of all of the things that they needed to do in their daily life. The home may also have functioned as a small business. A lot of people, if they ran a business, they usually would run it out of their home. And so the servants may have had to run the business while the master was gone. There would have maybe been children to take care of. There may have been meals to cook, bills to pay, things to clean, dishes to wash, animals to feed and groom. There would have been a lot to do. And Jesus says, if you're wise, you'll do those things. And then further he asks, he's like, what would happen if the master comes home in the middle of the night when nobody's expecting him to come back and the house is clean, the kids are all in bed, the books are all balanced, and the animals are all taken care of? He's like, what's going to happen? He says, well, the servant who's in charge is going to be commended and even promoted. But then Jesus asks, now what would happen if the master comes home in the middle of the night and instead, he finds that his servant has decided to get drunk, eat all the food, make a huge mess, and beat all the other servants. He's like, what's going to happen in that instance? He says, that servant is going to be in huge trouble. Now, Jesus tells us this parable. He's not really talking about a wedding feast and servants. He's talking about us, right? He's like, I'm ascending to the Father, and we don't know when he's coming back. But we do know he's coming back. And so the question for us is, when Jesus does come back, will he find us like the wise servants, you know, with the house clean and in order? Or like the foolish ones, will he come and find us, you know, passed out drunk with a lampshade on our head? And so, you know, one of the challenges for us as we follow Jesus is this open-ended nature of faith. There's no time limit to it. It's like you decide to follow Jesus and you follow him forever. Jesus never said anything like, hey guys, I'm going to come back on October 22nd, 2017, so be ready on that day. He doesn't say that. He doesn't even say it in some kind of like secret Bible code that someone's been able to figure out. He just says, I'm coming back soon, so be ready. Now, in Jesus' story of the servants, what happened to some of the servants when the master was gone? Well, the foolish servants, they forgot that he was coming back, right? So they got lax, and they got tired of keeping the house clean. And then after they got lax, they got sloppy, and then they just outright stopped doing their job. And so when the master came back, they're no longer doing what they were called to do. Now, the wise group, on the other hand, they kept the master's return in front of them. So they knew that their master was faithful. They knew that he was coming back. And they kept this thought in their minds, and they kept themselves ready. Now, with that in mind, when is it easiest to be a Christian? When is it most difficult to be a Christian? Well, in my experience, it's easiest to be a Christian when God's faithfulness is like right there in front of you. And so, you know, if I've gone through something hard and I've just found myself just praying and crying out to God to deliver me through something or rescue me through something, and then God steps in and he acts and he delivers me, that's when it's easiest to be a Christian, because God's faithfulness is like right there in front of me. Like, you can't miss it. Well, when is it toughest to be a Christian? Well, in my experience, it's toughest to be a Christian when you're going through something hard and you pray about it 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 and God doesn't act. So maybe like one of your kids is going through something and you're just trying everything to try to help them get through this, but it's just not working. And so you're praying about it, and you pray about it, and you pray about it, and your kid just continues to struggle, and you're like, God, why don't you help him get through this? What's going on? Or maybe you're struggling with some kind of addiction, and you're just tired of living with it, and you want to change, but you try, and you try, and you try, and you just keep failing, and you try, and you try, and you pray, and you pray, and you continue to fail. Or maybe there's a dream that you're pursuing and you just can't seem to make it happen. Like, for instance, maybe you're unemployed and you really want a job, but you just can't seem to get your foot in the door. Or maybe you're single and you want to get married, but you just can't seem to find the right person. Or maybe you're childless and you want a baby, and you pray about it, and you pray about it, and you pray about it, and God doesn't act. These are the times when it's toughest to be a Christian, the times when it seems like the master has been gone a long time and we're not sure that he's coming back. And this is what I think the Hebrews were going through in chapter 10. Now, last week, I reminded us that God is on our side, right? That he likes us and he wants us to succeed. And we got the idea from this theology that we have a great high priest, and then we have confidence to enter into the holy places, and Dick already alluded to that today. Now, I'm glad that we got to start off with this positive message and this encouragement that God is on our side, because we're going to need it this week, because this week's message is going to be pretty intense. It's pretty intense. This week, we're going to be in another one of the infamous warning passages in Hebrews. And the last time I preached on one of these, I mentioned, like, this is the reason why most churches don't preach through Hebrews. But we're not in most churches. There's just a couple places in the book where the preacher says, hey, you need to keep the faith, because if you don't, some really bad things are going to happen. And it's really intense, but it's part of the story of God, and so we need to hear it just as much as we need to hear the encouraging stuff. So with that in mind, I do want us to get into Hebrews chapter 10, and we're going to start in verse 26. He says, for if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a fearful expectation of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries. Anyone who set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the evidence of two or three witnesses. How much worse punishment do you think will be deserved by the one who has spurned the Son of God and has profaned the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified, and has outraged the Spirit of grace? For we know him who said, vengeance is mine, I will repay, and again the Lord will judge his people. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. All right. What do you think about adopting 1031 as like our new church slogan? Welcome to Believer's Fellowship. It is a fearful thing to fall in the hands of the living God. Pretty serious verses here in this passage. Like I said, I've said this before, the warning passages in Hebrews, they are just an infamous interpretive snake pit. There have been denominational splits over how to read these passages. Now, fortunately for you, I have it all figured out, and so you are going to get the right answers today, right? Okay. Maybe not. But what is going on here? Well, the logic of the section is, if you just want to follow the grammar and the logic of what the argument is, it is, if we go on sinning deliberately, then there is no longer a sacrifice for sins, but rather just judgment. And then he elaborates, it's not just any kind of judgment, it's just like fury of fire. Now, I see three major interpretive questions with this passage. We're trying to figure out, okay, what does all this mean? I see three big questions. The first question, and probably the most important, is what does it mean to sin deliberately? What does that mean? Second question is, what is this judgment that they're talking about? What does it mean that there's no longer a sacrifice for sins, but only a fearful expectation of judgment? Is that talking about some kind, like, is he talking about eternal judgment there? Or is it just maybe this temporal thing where maybe God's disciplining you, but you're still one of his people, something like that? What does that language mean? And then the third question is, what is going on rhetorically in these verses? Like, who are these verses talking about? Who is it for? Is this talking about a Christian? Or is this talking about maybe somebody who's in the church community, they're in the Christian community, but they don't really believe, they're just kind of hanging around them? And then whatever you do with that question, the follow-up question is, okay, well then what is it saying to that person? If it's a Christian, what's the warning? If it's a non-Christian who's just hanging out in the church, what's the warning? That's why I say, what is going on rhetorically with the verses? So with those three things in mind, I want to take a few minutes to answer each of those questions. And I want to start with the second one, because to me, that one's the most straightforward, the easiest to answer. Is this some kind of like temporal discipline, or is this talking about like final judgment, separation from the people of God? To me, the language is pretty unmistakable. I think it has to be talking about final judgment. There's this, it uses the language of a fury of fire that will consume God's adversaries. This is not the kind of language that the scriptures use to talk about the people of God and the way that God disciplines his children. God's children aren't his adversaries. Okay, this is serious language, serious stuff. So given that, what do we do with the first question? Remember, the first question I asked was, what does it mean to sin deliberately? Well, sinning deliberately is not just an incident where, like, something comes to your mind and you think, I'm going to do this. And then you sense the Holy Spirit saying to you, no, you shouldn't do that. And then you say, no, I'm going to do this. And you sin deliberately. That's probably not what these verses are talking about. There is a very specific sin that Hebrews has in mind. And how do I know that? Well, it's interesting what Hebrews compares sinning deliberately to. In verse 28, he compares it to the people in the Old Testament who set aside the law of Moses. And he's like, we know that people who set aside the law of Moses die without mercy at two or three witnesses. Okay, now what is that talking about? Well, this is an allusion to Deuteronomy chapter 13, verses 6 to 11. And that passage is about what the Israelites were supposed to do to someone who was encouraging them to abandon faithfulness to God and follow after idols. And so Moses in Deuteronomy 13 is like, okay, if you hear somebody say, man, this following God, this like following the law stuff, this just isn't working out. Like, I think we should go worship Baal. And Moses is like, if two or three people witness somebody encouraging the people to do that, you're just to take them outside and stone them to death without mercy. And so in that case, laying aside the law of Moses meant rejecting God and going back to the old ways, which, interestingly enough, is the exact same thing that Hebrews has been talking about for nine chapters, telling us not to do. It's exactly the same thing that the Hebrews were thinking of doing. They were considering laying aside faithfulness to Jesus and going back to the old ways. And so that is what sinning deliberately is referring to. It's talking about this apostasy and falling away from Jesus. And so Hebrews says, like, okay, after nine chapters of talking about this, you understand the gravity of rejecting Jesus. You can no longer say, like, if you do this, if you lay aside Jesus and try to go back to the old ways, you can no longer say it was an accident. Like, you know what you are doing. And so if you do it, it's a deliberate rejection of Jesus. And then he goes on to say, and if you do this, there's nothing to go back to. Like, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins. All that stuff that was going on in the temple, like, that's over. There's nothing to go back to. It's Jesus or nothing. So sinning deliberately refers to rejecting Jesus. So then that brings us to the third question, which is, what is the rhetorical effect of this passage? Or specifically, if you are currently a follower of Jesus, can you do this? Can you do this? And if you did, what would happen to you? Now again, this is not an easy question to answer. Like, there have been major denominations that have split over how they have answered this question, but here's my take on it. I see two tensions that run throughout the New Testament. I think the Bible teaches these two things at the same time. The first thing it teaches is that followers of Jesus have assurance of salvation. Hey, we have assurance of salvation. We can be confident that God's going to save us, right? The second thing that I see in the scriptures is that followers of Jesus need to persevere in their faith. And I think both of those things are true. Now, how can they both be true? How can we have assurance if we have to persevere? That's a great question. And the answer is that our assurance does not come from our ability to persevere. It only comes from the faithfulness of God. Right? Philippians 1:6, Paul writes, "And I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will carry it on to completion in the day of Jesus Christ." So Paul is saying that the same God who began this work of salvation in you will complete it, will finish it, will complete the work of salvation. He will work the perseverance in you. And so if someone asks you, if I were to come up to you and I were to ask you, how do you know for sure that you are going to go to heaven when you die? If you died today, how do you know for sure that you would go to heaven? If your answer begins with, "Well, because I," that's the wrong answer. Hey, that's the wrong answer. All of the right answers to that question begin with, "Well, because God," or "Well, because Jesus." Hey, our assurance of salvation always comes from the faithfulness of God, not in anything that we have done or not done. Now, similarly, if you're worried that you or someone you love has, like, lost their salvation, if that's possible, and I were to say to you, why are you worried about that? And your answer began with, "Well, because they," again, it's the wrong answer. It's because God. Our assurance depends on God. So there's this tension in Scripture that we have this assurance because of the faithfulness of God, but then we're also called to persevere. And Hebrews 10 emphasizes the perseverance side of it. Hebrews 10 emphasizes, like, hey guys, we need to persevere, keep the faith. It's Jesus or nothing. If we reject Jesus, there's no other options out there. Everything else is spent. There's no other sacrifices for sins. It's Jesus or nothing. So what do we do with that? What do we do with that? Well, Hebrews is going to continue in verse 32. So let's look here. He says, "Now recall the former days when, after you were enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those who were so treated. For you had compassion on those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. For yet a little while, and the coming one will come, and he will not delay. But my righteous shall live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him." All right, so we have this, like, grave warning in verses 26 through 31, and then that's followed up with verses 32 through 38, where there's this exhortation to keep going, right? And the preacher in Hebrews, he's like, hey, remember the early days? Remember your former days when you gladly endured suffering because you knew you had this better and this enduring possession? He's like, when you first came to Jesus, like, you had this passion. And, like, you didn't care if people mistreated you because of your faith. He's like, you visited people in prison. People confiscated your property and you didn't care. Like, you celebrated it because you knew you had something better. You had a better possession. He's like, remember those days? And I think what was true of the Hebrews is often true of us in our stories. You know, when we first encounter God, we just have this passion, right? We're excited for God. We're excited for our new faith. And, you know, we tell others and we don't care about like the grief that people might get us. If they call us a Jesus freak or something like that. We're so excited and just on fire. But then what can happen? It doesn't always happen, but what can happen? Familiarity can set in, right? Other things start to capture our attention. And, you know, we still want to follow Jesus, but we also kind of want these other things too. And so we'll follow Jesus as long as it doesn't keep us from getting these other things that we also want. And so familiarity can breed contempt. And I think, you know, as the saying goes, and I think we all know this from marriage, I meet a lot of young couples when I do, like, premarital counseling. And they, you know, young couples, they always come in, they've got just stars in their eyes over each other, okay? And as they should. And one of the sessions that we talk about as I'm preparing people for marriage is we always talk about conflict, all right? And I talk about, like, how to fight fair. And without fail, all of them were like, oh, we don't need to talk about this because we never fight, right? It's like, okay, you never fight, great. But inevitably, what happens, you know, a few months later? They're no longer saying, we never fight. And the stars in their eyes have dimmed a little bit. And why is that? Familiarity. And I think this is what the Hebrews were going through with God. That initial spark of their salvation had worn off, and they'd grown familiar with God. So one of my absolute favorite question to ask young people when I'm doing premarital counseling, my favorite question to ask them is, what was the one moment when you realized that he was the one? Or what was the one moment when you realized that she was the one? And I love asking people that because I love hearing the stories, but I also just love watching them as they tell the stories, you know, because it just brings them joy. Like I do remember the first time that I remember the first time that I knew that Brooke was the one, and it was when I took her home to my extended family over Thanksgiving when we were in college. So, like, both of our parents lived here in Washington, and we were going to school in Ohio, but I had family in Pennsylvania, so we would go to my family's for holidays and stuff. Now, I was struck by how beautiful Brooke is the first time I laid eyes on her, but it was at Thanksgiving where I knew, like, she was the one. What had happened, my aunt, and I've told this story before, she cooked us Thanksgiving dinner, and then as my family is prone to do, she's like, you know what, I'm just going to leave all the dishes for tomorrow. But Brooke, she would have none of that, okay, so she had other plans. She wasn't going to let this happen. So she came up with this plan. She's like, all right, we're going to wake up in the middle of the night and come down, we're going to do all these dishes in the middle of the night. And so we did that. We spent hours cleaning the whole kitchen. So then when my aunt woke up the next morning, she comes downstairs in the kitchen, everything's clean and put away and just sparkling clean. And I was blown away by how thoughtful Brooke is. And I knew from that moment that she was the one. I was 18. All right, so those of you, any of you who have teenagers, like, it's not very many years when it could happen, okay? I mean, but I love asking engaged couples that question because they just light up, like talking about that story. This is when I realized they were the one. And Hebrews challenges us to ask that same question about us and God. He's like, remember those early days? Remember those days, like right after you became a follower of Jesus? Like, why did you turn to God in the first place? What was it about the gospel that was so compelling to you? I mean, you had so much joy, like you suffered for Jesus and it didn't bother you? Now, the reason that I opened with this Jesus parable of the servants, kind of had the immediate connection to Hebrews 10 is maybe not obvious, but the reason I opened with that is because I think that's part of it. I think sometimes we slip into this mindset that the master's been gone a long time, and we don't know if he's coming back, and we've forgotten his promises. We've forgotten that he's faithful. We've forgotten these things, and we've just grown familiar with life. So how do we keep it fresh? How do we keep those early days in front of us? How do we recall the former days? Well, remember the question I like to ask to engaged couples. You know, when did you realize they were the one? Well, can we do that with God? Can we ask ourselves that question? I think we can with worship. Worship just has a way of bringing us back to the gospel story and why it was that we responded to God in the first place. Now, I'm not one of those people that listens to, you know, Christian music all the time when I'm at work or when I'm in the car, but occasionally I do. And it was a couple weeks ago, I think it's about 2 weeks ago, I was listening to Hillsong United's most recent album called Wonder, and there's a song in it called So Will I. And I've listened to it before, but I never really paid attention to the lyrics. And the song is based on Psalm 104. It's about how all creation praises God. And if you're not familiar with the song, like I said, it's called So Will I. And it has this refrain that says, you know, if all creation praises you, so will I. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I was listening to this, and there was a line that I just hadn't noticed before that stuck out to me this time. I didn't realize it, but the song takes a turn at the end, and there's a line where he says, if you left the grave behind you, so will I. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, that's good. I need to re-listen to this song. And so I rewound it, and I listened the whole way through, and this time I was like really focusing on the lyrics and reflecting on them. And as I did, God spoke to me. And I want you to hear hear some of the words from one of the last verses of the song. It says, God of salvation, you chased down my heart through all of my failure and pride. On a hill you created, the light of the world abandoned in darkness to die. And as you speak, 100 billion failures disappear. Where you lost your life, so I could find it here. If you left the grave behind you, so will I. I can see your heart in everything you've done, every part designed in a work of art called love. And if you gladly chose surrender, so will I. And listening to that, I just had I was just reminded of all the reasons why I believe the gospel. Now again, I didn't set out that day to have a powerful experience in worship. It just happened. God used the words to that song just to remind me of who he is, remind me of his promises. But if I hadn't shown up, if I hadn't shown up to worship, then it wouldn't have happened. And last week we talked about how, that's how worship works. You show up to do it faithfully. And when you do that, God, he uses it to bring you back. He reminds you of the former days. Now, to this point, it's been a pretty serious message, and but I do love how it ends. For 12 verses, the preacher is just like hammered into us this need to persevere. It's just been intense language, but it ends on a positive note, and I love how it ends. So let's look at verse 39 here. The preacher writes, "But we're not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who have faith and preserve their souls." Okay, I love how it ends. After having described the gravity of falling away, the preacher ends with, but we're not of those people who are, who shrink back and are destroyed. We're of the people of faith who preserve their souls. In other words, we don't have to be afraid. We're gonna make it. And I love that because this is exactly the kind of thing like I tell my kids all the time. So like, for instance, a couple weeks ago, Zach came up to me and he was super frustrated about this math problem he was working on. It was really hard and he couldn't get it and he just was emotional and flustered. And then not only that, but just angry at the injustice of it. He was mad at me for giving him work that included a problem that was obviously unjust and not fair for a kid his age. And I looked at it and I said to him, I was like, "You're right, Zach. That's a really hard math problem. It's a good thing that you're so smart. Otherwise, you might not be able to solve this." And then we sat down and we looked at it, and eventually he was able to tackle it and he solved it. I did the same thing, earlier in the week. Avery came up to me and she was working on a difficult piano piece and she was struggling and she was flustered and she was really upset and she was like, "This piece is impossible. It's too hard for me. I need something easier." And I said, "You're right. That is a really hard piano piece. It's a good thing you're such a hard worker. Otherwise, you might not be able to master this. But I bet if you practice, you will be." And she did. And she got it. So now, we've been talking about perseverance. And it's been a sobering discussion. The task is immense. The stakes are high. It doesn't seem doable. It might not even seem fair. And it's at this point that you might expect me to say something like, it's a good thing you're so faithful to persevere. Otherwise, you might have to worry about falling away. But I'm not going to say that. Because remember, that's the wrong answer. The right answer is, it's a good thing that God is so faithful. Otherwise, you might have to worry about falling away. Hebrews 10:23 tells us that he who promised is faithful. The master is away, but he is coming back. And God has an excellent track record of fulfilling his promises. Genesis 3:15, God promises Adam that he will defeat Satan and reverse the fall. Genesis 12:2-3, God promises Abraham, I will make your name great. I will make you a blessing. And through you, all of the families of the earth will be blessed. Exodus 19:5-6, God says to the nation of Israel, you will be my treasured possession, and you will be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. 2 Samuel 7:5-6, God tells David, your house and your kingdom will be made sure forever before me, and your throne will be established forever. Jeremiah 31:31, God says to the nation of Israel in captivity, the days are coming when I will make a new covenant with you, and I will put my law within you, and I will write it on your hearts. Now, none of these promises were answered overnight. Some of them took thousands of years to be fulfilled. But every single one of them was fulfilled in Jesus. God has a great track record of faithfulness. As another Hillsong United song says to God, you've never failed, and you won't start now. So if you're going through something hard, don't quit. Right? It might seem like God is inactive, but he isn't. He doesn't always fulfill his promises overnight, but he does fulfill them. Always. He's never failed, and he won't start now. Now, about 10 years ago, a movie came out called Taken, starring Liam Neeson. Have you seen this movie? If you haven't seen it, I'm going to spoil it for you, and I don't feel bad at all, because you've had 10 years to see this movie. But in the movie, Neeson, he plays this retired CIA agent, and his 17-year-old daughter decides to take a trip to Europe with a friend, and while she's there, kidnappers break into the house where they're staying. And she sees them break in, and she calls her dad, because she knows her dad is an expert in these kinds of things. She calls him and asks him, like, what do I do? And he's like, okay, this is what's going to happen. They're going to take you. And she's like, what? This is your plan? I thought you were going to help me here. And he's like, no, trust me. I want you to hide under the bed. I want you to resist as much as you can. And I want you to shout everything that you see into the phone. And then he adds, Kim, I will come for you. And so she does everything that he told her to do. Now, in the struggle with the young girl, one of the kidnappers picks up the phone. And there's this, this famous line in the movie. If you only remember one thing from this movie, you remember this conversation. When Liam Neeson says, I don't have any money for a ransom. But what I do have is a particular set of skills that are a nightmare for people like you. And if you let her go right now, I promise I won't come for you. But if you don't, I promise you I will find you and I will kill you. And the kidnapper just says, good luck, and hangs up the phone. Now, it's at this point, watching this as a parent, we were like, why would anyone watch this movie? This is the worst thing ever. Why would someone watch this? This is a parent's worst nightmare. But true to his word, Neeson's character is he is a man with a particular skill set, and he does track down these thugs who kidnapped his daughter. And the movie tracks him as he navigates this sinister underworld of human trafficking, and he moves from one hellish place to the next, fighting kidnappers and pimps and traffickers. And you're both impressed with his awesome spy skills, but then also you're just a little sick in your stomach as your imagination runs wild with the question of, what was it like for his daughter to be in this place before him? And the movie brilliantly doesn't answer that question. It never shows you what life was like for his daughter in those situations. It leaves it all up to your imagination. How much she suffered. How scared she must be. And whether she even knows that her dad is coming for her. Well, at the end of the film, Neeson's character, he finally catches up to this tycoon who has bought his daughter at an auction. And, you know, he's been pursuing her for 4 straight days, like fighting bad guys all along the way. And it's an action movie if you haven't seen it. Like, and he's been punched, he's been kicked, he's been stabbed, he's been shot. And the final showdown with his daughter's captors, you know, it's pretty brief. He makes quick work of her captor. But then when his daughter is finally rescued, there's this really short exchange between father and daughter. And they each say one thing. Now the dad, he's like covered in blood, and like some of it's his own from being shot, and others is that of the bad guys. He can barely stand from all of his wounds and from his exhaustion. And the daughter, you know, she just looks beaten and defeated. And you can tell from her countenance that all of those terrible things that were going through your imagination as your dad went from place to place and you wondered, you know, what could have happened to her, all of those things happened and more. And you can also tell that somewhere in her journey, she'd given up hope of ever being rescued. So like I said, the dad and the daughter, they each say one thing. The daughter, she collapses into her dad's arms in tears and in disbelief says, "You came for me. You came for me." And it's at this point, as viewers, that we remember like all of the places that he went through looking for her. And we wondered, like, you know, what must this have been like for the daughter, like in the drug houses, in the brothels, in the auction block? What must that have been like for her, not knowing that her dad was coming for her? And then the dad says his one line. "I told you I would. I told you I would." So here's the thing. Whatever you are going through right now, he's coming for you. He's coming for you. He told you he would. It might seem like the master has been gone a long time, but he's coming for you. He told you he would.